So we were talking about the mid-air gap and how it was known.
Well, it was known well before it actually occurred that it was likely to occur. And efforts were made to cope with it by fitting merchant ships with the naval aircraft, mainly old beaten-up Swordfish, and aircraft that could operate from short ships. And they weren't ready in time, and the Air Force people who had long-range aircraft would not release these aircraft to go on any submarine patrol, claiming they were more important for bombing Germany. And although there were airplanes at that time that could easily have done it, the Lancaster bomber, for example, was capable of huge long flights. It wasn't loaded too heavily. In fact, I did one trip in 1942 in a Lancaster to come home to get a destroyer, non-stop from Prestwick to Montreal, 15 hours. Which, you know, we flew right over the so-called gap, but the long-range aircraft were not provided in time, and that caused huge problems and many, many losses.
But there were some ships that did carry some older airplanes?
Yeah.
And were those retrievable, or?
Yeah.
All right.
They carried the old naval aircraft, the Swordfish, which can take off from a short aircraft deck. Uh-huh. But there weren't enough of those ships.
All right.
Well, eventually there got to be enough. Uh-huh. But there was a lot of havoc created because of the lack of air cover. Uh-huh. And it was well known. So it was bad management on our part, the higher levels of management.
Fair enough.
I don't think you'd find anyone who congratulated you.
It's very honest of you.
Well, I wasn't part of it.
True. One question which I wanted clarification on is, what exactly is a Captain D? Like, for example, Captain D Newfoundland.
Well, that meant that he was the captain. The D means destroyers.
Okay.
It was a title that sort of came out of the Royal Navy. If there were eight destroyers, say, in a flotilla, the senior ship had a captain on board. He was the captain of the ship. And he was the senior officer of the flotilla, and he was called Captain D. And it kind of has a nice ring to it. So people hung on to it.
Okay.
There are even pubs called that.
Oh. I didn't know that.
Yeah. One of the real innovations that was awful late in coming was refueling the escorts at sea.
Okay.
Now, in the Royal Navy had no arrangements for this at all at the beginning of the war. In fact, in the big ocean hunts for the German raiders like Scharnhorst, Gneisenau, and Bismarck, the British warships couldn't stay out there because their destroyers didn't have enough fuel. Mm-hmm. And the bigger ships did. They had no support from an escort group. And the British had no proper arrangements. Neither did the U.S. Navy. So really, looking back on it, height of
refueling at sea.
Stupidity, and then in about 1942, a system was developed. I think it was developed by an oil company, actually, to refuel us from tankers. And the technique was to tanker deliberately put into the convoy, and they trail the hose astern, and we grapple that and hook it up, and pump ourselves full of fuel again. And that extended the destroyer so we could easily do a transatlantic crossing.
Okay.
Prior to that, it was touch and go with the destroyer.
Especially if there was U-boat activity.
So you had to be careful. But after that happened, there was no shortage of fuel.
All right.
And then later on, fueling alongside developing, mm-hmm. where you went alongside the ship and fueling. And that's the method that's used now. Mm-hmm. Much more efficient. It is really, the equipment's kind of fancy, but the idea that mattered. And, it's basically, some of them should have thought that. It has a major oversight.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
Anyway, once we were refueling at sea, the Mid-Atlantic Gap, that could help close it too.
So I've read, some of the sources again that I've read have, some have been somewhat unfair, their treatment of the RCN during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Especially the, yep. the period of rapid expansion that the Royal Canadian Navy went through, and saying that there were some sailors were perhaps ill-trained and some of the vessels were not ill-equipped. But what I want to ask you is, now, do you think historians have been fair to the Royal Canadian Navy?
Marshall, to say that we were untrained and ill-equipped is a major understatement.
Yes.
Have you read my book about when I ran the training depot in Pictou?
Yeah, your section of the memoirs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was 22 years old. Mm-hmm. I just finished becoming an anti-submarine specialist. Mm-hmm. And I was told to go to Pictou to train corvettes coming down the river. Mm-hmm. I'm answering your question.
I know.
Now these, by that time, it was the beginning, just the end of 41, when the corvettes were starting to come off production line. The industrial people in Canada managed to put it together and get the equipment. Most of it shipped over from Britain, and the corvettes were coming. Now the Navy was busy trying to train crews for these. Completely inadequate. Our planning didn't progress anything like fast enough. Mm-hmm. But when I became an anti-submarine officer, there were only two others in the Navy. Mm-hmm. We are the specialists who teach the captains how to chase a submarine. Mm-hmm. And we have one Dutch submarine on the East Coast, and that was it. Mm-hmm. The training facilities were hopeless. We sent the corvette crews off from Halifax in 1940 and 1941. They could get across the Atlantic because the merchant marine captains had been recruited, so they could navigate. But our reserve people were highly unlikely to get them across. Yeah, not their fault. They just weren't trained. And the crew were ill-trained. Uh-huh. No, the criticisms that were leveled against us were correct. Uh-huh. I think everyone did his best, but we expanded the Navy too quickly. It was bad management. You're being too ambitious. Bring too many people to sea. Shouldn't have been there.
Do you think there's anything that historians have underplayed, that they haven't put enough significance on, in the role of, I guess, in the Battle of the Atlantic, so perhaps, people have looked at the Aztec, if there's a certain aspect or technology that you feel that perhaps history is neglected to look at?
I think the technology, the technology went along pretty well. I couldn't fault it, at least I never came up with any ideas myself that would have improved it.
What about the Welland plot?
No, I did actually. Yeah.
Do you want to explain that really quickly?
Well, anyway, getting back to the training, we just didn't make proper arrangements. We didn't have the people to train the people. Mm-hmm. When you think of putting someone 22 years old in charge of a training place, all the staff knew less than I did.
Fair enough.
So you can. There was a pretty low standard of training compared to, say, what the British were doing. And they only expanded their Navy three times. We expanded ours by 2,000 to 100,000, 50 times.
Fair enough.
It was silly, actually. Mm-hmm. We tried to do too much.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't want to hog up all of your day because I know the gentleman has to catch a ferry.
No, I don't have to catch
Not yet?
No.
All right.
Not for half an hour.
All right, well, good.
That you're going to ask me something about the magical Lelandaise.
Yes, pardon me. I'd like to hear about. Oh, I'd like to hear you explain it because I've read about it.
Well, it was when I was running this training place on Pinto. We had a Dutch submarine that had just escaped from Holland, mm-hmm. came to Canada, and he was our target. I'd spent my time in destroyers up till then, mm-hmm. and suddenly I was faced with training corvettes, mm-hmm. and they didn't have a gyro compass, and they didn't have a speed log, and because they didn't have that, they couldn't have an automated plot. It recorded your own speed course.
Okay.
The gyro compass fed into it, and the speed log fed into it, and the resolvers, the thing drew a map of where you would be.
Okay.
And that was fitted in all the destroyers. And when I went to a corvette, it had none of those things. So after one had attacked a submarine, you detected on the paint, you didn't need the plot for that. Once you'd run one attack on it, then the submarine would take off in whatever direction he chose. And the exploding depth charges, or even small ones, dumping arrows, left great echoes in the water, and turning the ship to two. So it was easy to lose the submarine after one attack with the corvette, even with an expert like me. And the Dutch submarine commander, he said, "What is the matter with you? You keep losing me all the time. I have to come up and sort of wave at you, say, here I am." And it was true. I kept losing him all the time, which really upset me. And it wasn't a great example to the corvette captains when the world's greatest expert couldn't do it. So, and I knew what the trouble was because we didn't have a plot, which told you where you'd been and what the submarine had been doing previously. So in 2 weeks, I invented this thing. It was quite simple, really. It required two sailors. One standing on the bridge with a chart, a special chart that I had made. One of the sailors, his duty was to have a stopwatch and read out the time every 30 seconds. Gave the other sailor who had the pencil the ship's course and the ASDIC range of the submarine. So, and the sailor with the pencil, he marked the ship's track, its course, and its speed on the chart with the little plastic hammer. So, by that means you could record the ship's speed and its course, and by laying off wherever it was, the submarine's range and bearing. So at the end of you had the ship's track traced on it and the submarine's track, so you knew where the submarine was. And the equipment cost me about $12, I think. and it took about 20 minutes to train the sailors how to do it. That all the corvettes and all the motor launches, our Navy and the British Navy, used that till the end of the war. Now, I should have been congratulated, but instead of that, no one ever paid me anything. I never got my $12 back.
No.
I asked for it. But I was criticized by the corvette captains who said, if you hadn't invented that, we would have been given a decent gyro compass and a log.
Fair enough.
The whole thing was a big mistake.
I was under the impression that gyro compasses were eventually brought in to the smaller vessels. That never happened?
No. The corvettes never got a gyro compass.
Okay.
Maybe toward the end of the war, they for any practical purposes.
And just to specify the difference between a regular compass and a gyro compass, for some who may not
you're
know.
Familiar with a regular compass. That's what you have in your fishbowl.
Yeah.
You have to apply deviation and variation, and if you bring your fish knife near it, the thing swings around and looks the other way. And it hasn't got very much turning power anyway. It was directional power. So, you know, it doesn't really... Anyway, it has no directional power. You can't take a feed off it.
Okay.
And get something else. And having no log, you know, faster, except for the Corvette X number revs means some speed. But the gyro compass tells you exactly which course you're steering. So there's no deviation, no variation. And the ship's log tells you how fast you're going. But the Corvette says none of that. None of that basic instrumentation.
So then, the Corvettes were obviously were somewhat adequate for theirs until your plot came around, somewhat inadequate to do anti-submarine warfare. Did they have hedgehogs and so forth?
They had depth charges. Yes, oh yes, they had depth charges. They had the same Aztec as the destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
The plot it added a little bit, but it wasn't that major thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a number had success.
Okay. Excellent. Let me just see if there's anything else here we can briefly go over. Well, how about how were escort groups organized or arranged? Like, would a group be specifically all Canadian and all American and all British, or
generally they were organized by the command ashore.
All right.
And the idea. Let's take 1943. That's when. 42 and 43, that's when...
It was heated, part, wasn't it?
A major effort was made on both sides. The typical... I think we had 15 destroyers.
Okay.
In the Canadian Navy at that time. And maybe we had 50 corvettes, some, maybe more. Now, if one runs a fleet, it's kind of like the city buses, you know. They have 100 buses, there are only 20 on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some are in refit, long refits, some are having boiler cleans, temporary out of action, so you get only X number. So a particular escort group would perhaps have 3 destroyers assigned to it, and maybe 8 corvettes. But at any one time, when you sailed out of St. John's, Newfoundland to escort a convoy, you found there was 2 destroyers and 5 corvettes.
Okay.
And the others were alongside the wharf getting fixed.
And we come out with the convoy?
No.
Or?
No, they were under repair.
Oh, pardon me. Okay.
The repair. Mm-hmm. And so there'd be that group of ships assigned by the shore to be that escort group. And there'd be, say, a Canadian in command of that. Now, the same thing applied to the British. They had the same organization, or we had the same organization. It was quite rare when you got a foreign, so-called non-Canadian ship in a Canadian group. Well, it did happen from time to time, and vice versa. I was in the British group 2 or 3 times.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are also did convoy duties up to St. Peter, into Russia and the USSR.
Yeah.
Now,
I made 2.
2 up there? Maybe you could...
No, funny enough, the convoy into Russia was not as tough as the convoying in the North Atlantic in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
The for instance, the ocean didn't freeze up there.
Okay.
And there were no icebergs. And fog was kind of rare.
Uh-huh.
And the winds were not as high. But, I found... Well, it was well known. It sounded kind of romantic, you know, convoy to Murmansk, but in point of fact, the weather wasn't as rough, and the opposition by the Germans wasn't as tough either. But it had a nice ring to it.
I like that. But there was so you're saying that you...
The darkness got to you.
Oh, okay.
I did one convoy in the winter.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because usually U-boats would attack during darkness, but I guess it wasn't seen as vital a trade route, perhaps, or?
Well, it was actually easier to route the convoys clear the submarines up north, because they could go way over toward Iceland and then up to Bear Island and come down from the top.
Okay.
And the sea never froze because it's part of the Gulf Stream. And whereas off Newfoundland, just awful. The ships up to Russia hardly ever iced. In the winter, it was a real menace to us, icing off.
Was it a constant effort, icing? Or?
Off, in the winter, yeah. Often. You know, usually in a fishing boat, for example, you don't have to go in a particular direction. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, run downwind when it's icy. But if you're escorting a convoy, you have to go.
This could be your livelihood.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So, I think the people who did the Russian convoys, if you ask them, they'd give you the same answer I had.
Mm-hmm. There's the...
But it's more fun for, if you're making a movie, to say about the Murmansk and St. John's, you know.
Well, I guess so. That's true.
Yeah.
That's very true. Now, we pretty much actually worked through most of my questions. Is there anything you want to add at this time that you felt that maybe I missed or didn't give you enough time to talk about?
I think one of the things that disappointed me at the end of the war was that the merchant marine people were not given enough credit for what they did.
Mm-hmm.
Now it was hard to give them credit because they were a disorganized group. They were civilians off the street. They were put into a pool. They were volunteers. Often they weren't. People didn't know even who they were, and they were put on board merchant ships. And once they were on, they couldn't get off. You know, they were basically confined. But their losses were far higher than ours, the naval losses. And but they kept at it. They could all run away and desert it. They didn't. And it wasn't because they were getting huge amounts of money. They were an outstanding group, and they haven't, since the war, been given enough credit for that, in my opinion.
They were the true targets.
Yeah, they were the targets. And you just have to look at the stats to see how many were killed as compared to the Navy.
Very true.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great point, and perhaps we should end it on that note.
All right,
well, thank you very much for your time. And
thank you, I enjoyed it.
Making this special weekend over in Victoria, coming from Surrey. So, well, thank you, and have a good day to whoever's listening.